Hello, I'm Peter Deegan. I'm the lead tutor for the RSSL Auditing Career Pathway and Suite of Training Courses. Welcome to the next podcast in our series of My Auditing Journey. These interviews are aimed at talking with experienced auditors from across industry to gain from their knowledge and experience in auditing. And it's an important part of any auditor's continuing professional development activities to learn from others, in my opinion. So it's therefore my great pleasure to welcome Tony Orme, former expert GDP inspector for MHRA, and now one of our eminent RSSL tutors on our GDP courses, and most recently our newest audit training course, GDP Auditing. Welcome, Tony.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tony, it might be useful if you could give us a brief career path history for yourself and how you ended up where you are in that seat today from your illustrious career.
Yeah, it's one of those weird by chance careers that I don't think can ever happen anymore. Way back in the midst of time, I was just working in a very dull job in insurance, and there was an open application for executive officers in the civil service. It involved a 3-hour exam and then an interview. And then once you passed that, then you just got randomly dropped into the civil service. And I just so happened to be randomly posted into the Medicines Control Agency, as it was at the time, way back in 1990, with no background at all in medicines or regulation or management. And I was in charge of a team of 7 people. We were preparing product license renewals for the marketing authorizations. And I did that for a few years, managed to sort of get a grounding in how the agency worked. And I was looking after product license registration, parallel imports, and bits and pieces like that. And then that job changed and I moved into a vacancy in the MHRA enforcement team, which I did for about 5 or 6 years, which was an amazing experience, tending to be effectively the policeman for MCA. We used to go around chasing the bad guys, doing surveillance, getting search warrants, searching people's houses, taking people to court and prosecuting them. And that's kind of like the basis of the auditing journey, because we got quite a lot of police training in interview techniques, how to build cases and to build a body of evidence to justify a criminal prosecution. I did that for a number of years. While it was interesting, it was also incredibly frustrating in that it would take an absolute, you'd have the 5 minutes of excitement of doing the raid and getting the evidence. Then you spend almost 2 years trying to build a case file to get it to court. Used to go on for ages and just get really annoyed with solicitors that what you thought was an open shut case somehow didn't have the evidence they were after. And then it just so happens that we've been doing that for a while. And then the MHRA presumably had more of this, just the one inspector at the GMP team that were doing the bulk of the work, and they were getting more and more pressures on their time. So they decided it was time to create a GDP team just as an experiment, really, just to see if they could give that work to sort of non-technical experts to look at the wholesalers. And they ran a pilot for 6 months. They brought a number of people in, primarily from the enforcement group, really. I think there were 5 of us at the start. We sort of took over that work from the MHRA GMP teams, which was quite a steep learning curve. We had a week's worth of training on site, and then we went out with various GMP inspectors to see how it was carried out. Yeah, so we had that sort of handed over, and the trial worked. We could see that it was a different level of audit from what was required from GMP. Typically at the time, they were fairly short inspections because GDP back then was, I think, 2 pages of notes, 30 clauses. And that was really the start then. So that was way back in 2002, I think. So we were doing audits and gradually sort of getting out there and understanding the way that the wholesale market worked, visiting all these different companies. And as the team built up over the years, GDP was rewritten in 2013. Also internally within the group, we were improving processes, raising expectations and standards, and we started driving things like the GDP symposiums and GMP symposiums, putting more and more stuff out there to sort of raise the standard across the sector. So yeah, it was a sort of strange journey. I never expected to be where I got to, but in the end, I was trying to do some calculations of how many inspections I've done. I think it's at least 1,000, maybe more. And it's crossed, you know, from single trader that I visited in their bedroom upstairs to, you know, global pharmaceutical companies, Ministry of Defence, trips overseas, speaking at conferences worldwide. It's been an amazing journey, just purely by chance.
Fantastic. It's a very interesting point you raised about I remember when I was learning my QP, I got my QP in 95, and there were three European directives came out, the suite of three, one ended 23, 4, or 5, and that was the early days of GDP. So essentially, you've grown up and been part of the emerging standard set, really.
Completely, yeah. I mean, way back in 2001, I think it wasn't even in the law. So the GDP was there, and it wasn't until the 2005 consolidation of the medicines regulations that it actually became law. So for a period of time, we were enforcing GDP without a legal basis, but it was a little bit smoke and mirrors, but everyone fell into line.
Well, maybe we can discuss that a bit more, because in the IRCA lead auditor course, an ISO 19011, the standard auditing standard that we use, they put a lot of emphasis on setting the correct audit criteria. And when you say you're out of compliance, you're allowed to say with what regulation, with what words. So that ambiguity must have been very difficult to really articulate the non-conformance, I guess.
It was. And it's a real discipline that took a lot of time to get right. I think when you first start out, there's a little bit of subjectiveness to that, particularly when it was the early GDP, because there was very little to hang your hat on. You know, you had a couple of clauses about products, about transportation, and trying to drive compliance over very little detail. And if you weren't careful, you fell back on referencing like MHRA policy, which wasn't law. So what also is required is that we used to have regular team meetings once a month where we would go over and review the inspection findings and make sure that everyone was in line in terms of checking that the deficiencies that have been given, the findings that they're given, were actually at a basis in law. So there's, I think, sort of success of the program is all about sharing information, because there's the bit, you know, 90% of the audits are solo inspections. You're going out by yourself, interacting with the company, reporting that. And it's only when you get back as a group together and sit there and review what's actually been written, what's been set out, that there's that common standard and approach. That's kind of probably the most important bit about any inspection group of the regulators. They sort of review the findings and then come to an agreement that, you know, what's an acceptable finding. Does it actually have basis in the guidelines and law?
Fantastic. I need to ask the first question, because we've almost gone through half of the content of today's interview really on that alone. I will come back to that. It's a real skill that we find when auditees come on the training courses, you know, in the first part of the course, is that they're all over the place, and we can really walk around as the mock auditee. We can just put holes through their argument, etc. And it's a real skill to be able to, as you say, to articulate the audit criteria and the non-conformance. And it's a tried and tested and practiced technique to get right, because the auditee will be the world's expert in what they do. And you've got to come in as an auditor and have a snapshot of what they're doing and make a quick judgment, really. You've got to be a sound judgment, really.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always interesting in terms of the approach that companies take to the MHRA inspection, because quite a lot of the time they won't necessarily agree with what the inspector's provided as a deficiency, but there's a reluctance to challenge the inspector as they are, you know, they're the regulatory expert, even though potentially that they know in their own mind that they're not correct.
It's, yeah,
an interesting place to be. Part of my role while I was there was I was the GDP lead on the inspection action group for quite a few years. So that's where there's critical inspection findings that found you'd review peer review the inspection outputs from the inspector, what's known as a type 4 letter, which was setting out the critical findings. And that's used as then the legal basis potentially to suspend the license or to take a responsible person off license. And that's the bit where you really have to be super accurate. And it was an interesting process to sort of peer review what people have put down as, like you say, the non-conformances. Then you actually go back and say, well, actually, you know, you really need to reference this super accurately, because this is the bit you're hanging it off. So even experienced inspectors don't get it right every time. And it does need, if you're doing that sort of impactful letter that's going to seriously impinge on a license, it does need that, it has that peer review that's really important.
Oh, it's so funny you say that, because that's one of the elements that we drill in our RSSL lead auditor course. It's not necessarily even explicit in ISO 19011, when you're doing your closing meeting and you're saying, you know, we found this, and then you get a riposte, and you can say, well, look, clearly even I will have to have a peer review of my audit report back at base just to make sure, but here's my position at this moment. The final report will give you the final outcome. It's really important.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the bit for companies. Even if they feel they don't want to change it at the closing meeting, there's that opportunity to think about it later when they're responding to the findings.
Yeah, absolutely. My first question I usually ask all my interviewees is, what was your first audit and what was your experience and what did you learn from it?
The first audit I can really remember was an audit that's not too far from where I live. So I think I've been reasonably recently accredited, and it was an operation sort of that was linked to a pharmacy, or it was above a pharmacy. So those kind of operations are also a little bit run on a shoestring. So they have the pharmacy downstairs, and you visit the pharmacist, say, I come to do your inspection about your wholesale license, and then take you through the sort of the dingy back area of the pharmacy, maybe upstairs. And this chap had like a house that had been converted into a pharmacy, so upstairs like bare floorboards and tatty old refrigerator, the stories of medicines. And I was amazed at how poor everything was. I remember opening looking at the temperature records of the fridge, and there everything was out of limits and dirty, and the records were really poor, and there was a real lack of procedures. It was a pretty poor show. That one really stuck in my mind because it was sort of, I think it was one of my first audits, and I had to start writing a really strong post-inspection letter to drive compliance. And but I just remember my finding this stuff, and my heart started beating, thinking, oh my goodness, I was expecting something to be quite simple. This is really challenging. You've got to sort of gather the evidence, present it to the person that's right there in front of you, and it's more or less your first independent audit. So it's an interesting experience.
I think that's typical of most people who I interview, who say, firstly, the romance was lost in the first minute. Secondly, really importantly, there's a human in front of you trying to do their job, and it's either through belligerence, incompetence, or others, and it's how do you help them move on? Because at the end of the day, if it's one thing I've been passionate or I have had the great privilege in my pharmaceutical career, is there's a patient at the end of it, and that's where medicines and healthcare are trying to give the benefit. And our role is to say, are these medicines being controlled so they don't harm the patient at all? And when you see a scenario in front of you, you just want to help them out, but you've also got to stand back and just go, whoa, hang on a minute. You know, what is the requirement for the license holder and the patient?
Yeah. I mean, there's that bit with the regulatory hat on where this will be. It's all about presenting the findings of stuff that's gone wrong, and you generally don't cross over into that bit of trying to help them. But equally, as a human, if you're sitting there doing the audit, the people are being, you can see where they've gone wrong. You've got to help them out as much as you can within the bounds of the role. And that's quite I really like this moving over to the consultancy side. Now I can actually do that bit where I wanted to help them, and now I can help, which is a great place to be.
It's so very funny you say that. I've experienced that. I went freelance 9 years ago and worked for, 25 years for a corporation and internal and supplier audits. And you have that very strong badge to the auditee in front of you, whereas there is a professional conflict of interest sometimes where you can't give that, in the course we talk about, you can't offer free consultancy. You've just got to put the non-conformances in front of them. That's a stage beyond that. But I do like the freedom to be able to advise. There's no doubt about that. In some ways, it's a real dichotomy as an auditor, isn't it? Because you just want to go, look, it's easy. Why don't you do this? And you've got to really stand back and look at the regulations, given the non-conformance. I think the other challenge as well, Tony, it'd be interesting to hear from your thoughts on this, is you want to help them, but you can't help them.
Yeah. I mean, I particularly see that when, if you go in and find a critical finding, there's bits for where I've unfortunately seen far too many people that it's deliberate incompetence or criminal actions, and don't want to help them at all. But equally, I've visited companies, where you can really see they're trying to do the right thing, but they've either grasped completely the wrong end of the stick in terms of what the regulations require, or they've missed something, or someone's let them down. And your heart sort of goes out to those people, and you really want to sort of push them in the right direction. And it's quite upsetting sometimes when you see people who put their heart and soul into a business, and they, you know, they put themselves in a really bad place by not thinking clearly about what it is that they're doing.
I think there's almost like a three-stage distribution. There's the new startups who are just really trying passionately to want to do and be successful, but they have lack of knowledge and competence, as we would call it, in terms of sort of that maturity. Then you've got the sweet spot where they've learned a bit, but actually you can get complacency then starts to come in from the more mature organizations. And I really like the FDA's call to maturity model that's coming through as well, to be able to assess the levels of maturity.
I mean, certainly that's the way I think the MHRA are looking to move in the future, is that similar to sort of the FDA, is if companies can demonstrate that they've got a level of maturity in terms of quality management systems, and they're open to providing data to support that to MHRA, then there'll be inspection bonuses in terms of they won't potentially look at them as frequently as they would do companies that are less mature. So yeah, if companies move towards that status, then I think there'll be bonuses for them in over the next few years.
And I think setting an effective internal audit program to elicit that level of maturity, I think is the way forward.
It is. Effective is really the key. You know, I think that's, I mean, when there's a regulatory inspection, you know, the inspector brings all their experience to the table. With that, there's the inspector luck. They was meant to put their finger on the thing that the company haven't thought about. And that's the basis of, you know, hundreds of inspections. They know where to look for things that are going wrong. I think that's something that's quite hard to replicate in an internal audit. You sort of don't know what you don't know. But equally, that there's definitely scope for having more effective internal cell inspections across organizations, I think, because, you know, with the best will in the world, the MHRA tend to be expecting between sort of 3 and 4 years across the cycle. So it's expectation that the company are managing their own affairs in that time. So if there's a regulatory audit and it's clear everything's gone wrong for the last 4 years, the finger gets pointed at the RP and the internal audit process as being ineffective, and, you know, that can jeopardize the career of the person that's supposed to be managing the internal audit processes.
Yes, very much so. Maybe I could explore the GDP environment, as we were talking in the introduction, that, you know, it's been an emerging legislation over the years from experience, and we've now got the responsible person. How is a GDP audit different from a GMP audit? Because to my mind, could be belligerent and say GDP is a lot easier. It's just warehousing and management of the distribution, isn't it? A lot to cover. So RP's got it easy.
I say up to maybe 2013, they probably did have it easy, to be honest. Quite often it was Fred the warehouse man that would be allocated the job of RP through sort of last man standing, because, you know, of course the standards weren't particularly, well, they weren't particularly detailed. There were some expectations of what the role entailed, but it wasn't backed up by any form of legislation. So up until that point, GP audits, they'd typically be half a day tops. Once the GDP guidelines came in, that much more closely aligns the GDP standards with GMP in terms of the standards, and they were written that way in terms of the chapters that very much follows the structure of the GMP guide, with the expectations across the various different sectors. And at that point, really, the RP's job became a full-time role, and you can't be Fred the warehouse man managing a warehouse. The whole quality of the operation is now, say, it's a full-time job. And then the MHRA very much moved away from saying the managing director could be the RP as well. It needs to be a separate role from the commercial side of things. You know, there needs to be they need to be clearly set aside from sort of the day to say commercial decisions of what the company does, so they can actually provide that reassurance to the license holder that the levels of the company operation that fully meeting the obligations of what's required within the legislation.
It's interesting you talk about Fred the warehouseman coming in, all of a sudden becoming the RP. What competence expectations do you see on the responsible person as regards auditing? We've just got the new GDP audit course come out. That's because of a lot of demand from the GDP Cogent course, where they're saying, well, how do I audit against that? I've got an inspection. What do I do? How do I plan? How do I prepare? Is there value in a minimum competence in auditing or being an auditee for a responsible person or a GDP professional? Or is it somebody else's problem?
Well, it's very much defined in the guidelines under Chapter 2 that the RP is responsible for ensuring that there's the self-inspection programme in place.
So yeah, exactly.
It's a clear part of their role. It's not something that I don't think that there's a huge amount explored in terms of the current sort of Coaching Gold standard. So in terms of the training, the expectations from the MHA are a little light on that at the moment. When someone gets appointed as RP, there's an interview of them now. So that's something new that's happened over the last few years. So if you've not been an RP before, the variation goes into naming you on a wholesale dealer's license. You'll be subject to an interview over a virtual interview through the Teams channels that'll ask you questions about the license, what your experience is, how you understand the operation of the company and your background knowledge of GDP. It doesn't particularly sort of prod the knowledge of self-inspection, but I think there's sort of possibly an element of expectation that if you're going to be an RP, you need to be aware that by taking on that role, it's your job to make sure that everything is going on under your name and it's done effectively. And the only way to do that is through self-inspection. So there's a sort of expectation that if you stood up for that role, you've got suitable knowledge to do some auditing to satisfy yourself that by putting yourself on the license, you're happy that you know what's going on. So while I don't think there's anything explicit about the background, I think if you haven't got an auditing experience, you need to get it because it's a really challenge to do that role without that sort of level of skill and additional knowledge. I mean, so much of an operation is about people. Over the years, you could see from a company that was used to rank them as number one in terms of compliance, and so much of it was down to the RP. When the RP left, you could just watch the company nosedive. And it's so important that what people bring to in terms of quality to the organization. And if someone's not there cracking the whip, driving that, the whole operation go off a cliff really quickly. This stuff really needs to be embedded, and if people are leaving, they need to be replaced with people of equivalent skills and drive.
I want to talk about the role of the qualified person versus the responsible person. We've now got the responsible person, who is that focal point. We've got Annex 16 and the QP and their needs to understand the supply chain. How much interaction or knowledge should the qualified person have on the GDP processes? Because in one way, GDP happens after QP certification, and after QP certification, the QP has handed over full responsibility to the responsible person now, surely.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly sort of the way that the supply chain has moved these days. So even if you're a manufacturer, quite often there's a discrete manufacturing side of things, and then products get sold off to further down the supply chain. So I think with EU exit, Brexit, and the whole disruption of the supply chain in terms of moving stock from the EU into the UK, so you've now got the responsible person for import, which is effectively QP light in terms of the way it's been set up. So I mean, there's the expectation the responsible person has the years of experience as a member of a professional body. There's a bit of a more of a bleed of the crossover, that quite often the RPI and the RP are the same person. And there's sort of a bit of crossover in terms of what the expectations are for that versus linked to QP, because they want to know how the product's been sourced from the EU, how it's been transported, has some evidence of QP certification. So there's that sort of element of professionalization of the RP, the RPI, that's a little bit more equivalent to what the QP has. It's obviously not as rigorous in terms of the training expectations and the years that go through it. But in terms of what the QPs need to do, I think if they're involved in the ordered supply chain, if it's an integrated company and it's moving from QP certification through to a pre-wholesaler, for example, and it's sold on, there needs to be that little bit of element of knowledge. Something I've seen recently as a company I've done some work for, and stuff was normally been sort of, it'd be manufactured and then it'd be moved off to another organization. But the way the financial flows have been set up, you've transferred ownership to the wholesale operation before it'd been QP certified. So effectively the QPs had lost, it was no longer their stocks. It'd been sold on to another company, but they were QP certifying it after it'd been sold on to the wholesaler. So it was effectively an illegal transaction within their own companies.
Right.
So it's one of the things that, in terms of the systems were great. but there was stuff happening outside their view because they sort of didn't have a full view of the supply chain.
I guess in terms of an auditing approach, again, the qualified person being responsible under an X16 and towards batch certification, but must be knowledgeable of the supply chain. And in many ways, that's that precursor supply chain, you know, from the manufacturer to certification. Post it is distribution. But the qualified person clearly has a responsibility in recall and therefore must know the distribution chain and have the reliance upon and the contact with and the dialogue with the RP to ensure that they've got robust recall processes in place. So the qualified person in some ways has a duty, obligation, opportunity to shape the internal audit program for the RP to say, can we do that? You know, do the recall test. You've got to do a recall test periodically. Why not let the audit be part of that process? And therefore, the qualified person has a much more robust understanding of that rather than I've certified it and somebody else will do it for me.
Yes. I mean, I think you see that sort of level in big pharma that have got operations across different countries. Because, you know, there's usually the global audit teams that are working together to make sure those activities are covered. I think it's more of a challenge for smaller companies without that sort of global pressure.
Yeah, very much so. I want to go now to discuss the auditing process. In our IRCA lead auditor courses, the internal two-day audit courses that we run, majority of trainees have done some auditing. And these audit training programs that we run give you much better structure, much more on the ISO standard, which is a great process. And it goes into a lot more detail. It talks about the structure, about the planning, preparation, the plan, do, check, act process. From your experience as an MHRA inspector, how do you structure an audit?
So we would get typically maybe about a 6 week to a month's notice of what your expectations were for the next month in terms of, say, three or four inspections to do over the next month. So you start off by sort of mapping when you go to fit them in terms of your schedule. And that would be the initial contact of the company saying, we're going to come and do a regulatory inspection. And then you'd, at that point, you'd give them a list of documents that would help you prepare for the inspection. So typically for me, I would ask for a copy of the quality manual, list of potential deviations, change controls, CAPAs that have happened in the last 12 months as a sort of preparation for the audit. And then I would look at the last inspection that had been carried out in terms of the findings, read the last audit report. So half a day, a few hours of preparation to sort of set the scene for what it is that you're going to see, what's the sort of size of the company, how have things changed, probably do some sort of open source looking at the company in terms of, you know, is there anything in the news about them, if they have any product recalls, any sort of big scandals. Generally, it's usually something you can find out before you go and visit a company that shouldn't influence you, but it's sometimes useful to get a bit of background about something that's out there. Review the licenses in terms of what's the scope of their activities, has that changed significantly since the last inspection. And then companies were asked to complete a sort of pre-inspection questionnaire as well, which sort of detailed significant changes in terms of personnel and IT systems. So you have a pack for you when they'll give you that basis for the audit. Typically, regulatory inspections or GDP ones don't tend to have an audit program sort of provided for the company, because most of them tend to be a day. If it's going to be longer, if it's a two-day, two-person audit, then there will be an audit schedule, a plan sent out, because if it's a bit more of you than one of you on site, it's more difficult to manage in terms of having two people hosted. But for the typical inspection, it's one person, one day. So that would just, you go and visit the company and you'd open with the scope of the inspection, which would be a GDP audit against the standards of the human medicines regulations. And then you'd typically start with an opening meeting with the company, get their understanding of what it is that they do, and then just work through. Typically, start for me looking at some of the transactions first. I always like to sort of see what they were buying and selling, then go through the warehouse talking to people, and then match that to the procedures and quality systems at the end. But sometimes you change it up and do it the other way around. But it's, for me, I always like to sort of see what activities are being carried out and then see if the, you know, those activities actually meet what's written down in in the terms of the procedures and the records that are actually being generated in the way that people have told you they're being generated.
So what you're saying is you see it happen first and then reconcile it back with the data to see whether they're congruent.
Yeah, I mean, it works both ways, but sometimes I've found that you can almost get lost in the detail. You can spend sort of 3/4 of the day just reading procedures and reading the quality manual, and then that leaves limited time for actually going and seeing the real world. So, you know, it's always a balance when you're doing an audit in terms of time available, you know, versus time for review. So, yeah, that was the way I tend to talk about it in the regulatory field. I think it's different now you're consulting. I think it's obviously a different mindset in terms of time available and time you want to spend with the client.
One of the common feedbacks that you get is, as an auditor, the auditee gives you the 45-minute company PowerPoint presentation. How valuable are they, and are they of any use?
I think they're quite useful to sort of set the scene up. I think it's good for the company to be able to set out their stall. And so it gives, in the start of the day, an audit is generally quite stressful. I mean, particularly a regulatory audit, there's always quite a lot riding on that. You know, so there's introductions, and it allows everyone to sort of take a breather, come in to sort of set out their stall, say, this is what we do. I think probably 45 minutes might be stretching it a little bit.
I've had them.
So definitely companies can trim their sort of corporate ethos and yeah, some of the other sort of bits and pieces that are hugely relevant to the during the day's audit. But I think generally they're a good scene setter.
The best one I've ever had was I was doing a CSV audit, and they said, right, we're going to give you the company presentation now. And I went, well, yeah, what can I just say? You know, I haven't got a lot of time. And he went, trust us. He says, we get these audits all the time, and I think it's going to be 45 minutes, but it will save you 3 or 4 hours. I went, okay. And it did, and they just give you the standard answers. You're going to ask this, this is our answer. You're going to ask that, this is our answer. And I really like that. I think that's very valuable, and it helped me set the scene a lot quicker. And they clearly understood. And at the end of the audit, I was saying, have you been ISO trained on auditing? And they went, yeah. He said, you know, it's, you know, we know what you're doing. And also as well, what we've also learned is that for those auditors that may not have gone through an official training program or may not be as experienced, he says, we help to steer and coach them to audit correctly as well. And I thought that was a real win-win. I really liked that. I did.
Yeah. I mean, companies have had multiple audits. You know, it's a slick process. I mean, obviously, it's the experience, you don't want to be pushed down a certain channel. So you have to be alive to that you're potentially being managed. So, yeah, that's also an auditing skill that you need to become aware of.
So what, in your experience, what are the key gaps that auditees make in preparing for and executing an inspection? How can they make things easier for the auditor or the inspector? What are the common pitfalls? I found that certain companies, they're trying to hide information, they're trying to withhold information, they're trying to preempt what the inspector or the auditor may want to see, and it kind of gets in the way. How can they be slicker? What are the expectations that they should understand in the first place to make the audit or the inspection easier? You know, what's the common information you're after?
I mean, usually there'll be a pre-inspection request or documentation that says we need to have everything available for review. And I think some companies just sort of haven't thought through what it is that is likely to be asked. I mean, there's a lot of clues in terms of MHRA. I haven't done it recently, but you know, the top five deficiencies relate to quality management systems, transportation data, custom and supplier qualifications. You know, that is the stuff that's routinely going to be asked for. And that, you know, generally there's quite a lot of information there, and that's the stuff that's going to get asked for. So have it readily available. If you've got, typically, if you've got stuff that's sitting in an old computer system that's archived, have someone available that can go back and generate that data without taking all day. If it's transportation data, you know, MHRA are going to ask you for stuff about a particular day that was the coldest day of the year and the hottest day of the last year. That's just the way they ask for data, because it's, you know, why not pick the most extreme? So, you know, have that data ready. They're going to ask for the 24th of July, they're going to ask for the 1st of February. So, yeah, don't be surprised. Try not to speak. The whole point of a regulatory audit is to
poke the weak spots. So if you know you've got some weak spots, obviously you want to anticipate that before the audit, because you want to put some corrective actions in place. But deeply, that's the, you know, the data they're going to be asking for. When they're auditing qualification suppliers, they're looking for sort of like unusual companies. So I don't know, if you've got a customer that's based in Afghanistan, that's the one that's going to catch their eye, because they're all, never seen anyone supply in Afghanistan before. So what's their regulatory process? Yeah, they're not just going to think, okay, you supply GSK. Well, that's kind of easy to qualify. But if you've got a tiny little company that they've never seen before, that's the one they're going to pick on.
As an auditor, inspector, you've said as well, particularly on inspection, a regulatory inspection, there's a lot riding on it for the auditee. And there is a human skill to help the auditee overcome nerves, fears, etc., for the auditor to manage difficult or blocking behaviours. What skills does an auditor need? What are the best skills to put people at ease, given that you're in essentially a powerful position? You know, what type of behaviours and skills do you use to help people manage their stress levels, really?
Yeah. I would think you just have to come over as sympathetic, really. I mean, it is quite easy to do these things automatically when you sort of walk into a room, it's your third inspection of the week. You're like, yeah, this, and that doesn't help anybody. You know, it doesn't appear. You need to be engaged with the company. You need to treat every person you audit or inspect as they've not been inspected by you before. So you need to introduce yourself, set out a story of what it is that you're there to do. Potentially provide some reassurance. You can usually tell by body language when people are nervous about inspection. Like, you know, and if you just sort of sit back, you can sort of see a little bit of shaking of the hand, or well, there's a lot of rustling of papers and people sort of moving around nervously, versus companies that are completely comfortable with it. You know, they're bringing in coffees and they're having a little bit of a small talk before the meeting opens. And clearly, as an individual, you get a quick snapshot of how comfortable people are at the audit. And if they're not comfortable, then you need to take the time to sort of set the scene, say it's not a test, and you know, lay out the stall. You know, I'm here just to objectively look at how the operation's running. But you know, sometimes you just audit companies that are just, you know, they've put up a wall and don't want to engage. You ask for documents, the documents don't arrive, and you're asking a question, they're asking a different question. And that's where you sort of need to take your empathetic hat off and just sort of start either asking closed questions, sort of taking that step back, maybe even taking a 5-minute break and saying, like, can we just pause here and let's have a conversation about, you know, well, we're here to do a job, you're here to provide the evidence, let's restart again and see if we can make this an audit more successful than it has got to this stage.
That's exactly my experience on the cup of tea thing. I think I was in India and I was doing an audit. Yeah, everybody's got the back room. We used to call it the war room. It's we all know what we got in it, etc. You know, and you know, as an experienced auditor, that there are people getting documents, chasers, etc. And they had this early days of Teams chat sort of thing. They're trying to talk to each other, and they were clearly struggling to get the document. And you could see the stress levels, cortisol levels, start to rise visually. And I just said, "Are you having difficulty finding it?" Because this classic belligerent inspector, "I want it in 10 minutes or otherwise I'll fail you" sort of thing, that caricature. And they went, "No, we're finding it." I went, "Let's have a cup of tea. Give yourself time. Shall we say by 4 o'clock? Vroom." And you know, and I got some lovely feedback at the end of it. They said, "You've no idea how that de-stressed us, because you were human." And I just thought, well, we're all human. And I think that's it is a skill for an auditor. There is a line. There's the, can I have that? Yes. Can I have that? Yes. Can I have that? Yes. Well, you haven't got it, have you? No, because of certain cultures can't say no because of dishonour, etc. You sort of read the room on that. But we've both got a job on both sides of the table, and it's a professional job. It is a pressurised job. And it's, once again, the mantra I always put is, we're doing it for one person, really, and that's the patient. So let's do it together. It's really important. If there are deficiencies which may have an impact upon patient safety, then let's reconcile it together and fix it. And I think you can't go much further wrong than that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd say 95% of the people I ever visited were always really receptive to the whole object of it. There's only sort of the 5% that weren't. So I think it's an order, the vast majority of total time, everyone's on the same page, which does make it a much more enjoyable experience.
Tony, thank you very much for your insight today. I hope that those listening in have benefited and gained some knowledge about what it's like to be an inspector. Thank you for your time today. A really interesting discussion. And I look forward to working with you in the RSSL tutor environment very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Peter. Yeah, it's been interesting to sort of delve in my memory and talk some tales.
And interesting and insightful they were. Thank you very much, Tony.